As a precursor to my remarks, I'd just like to say I've tried to tailor them a little bit differently than those from last Tuesday, where we had a general theme of climate change signals in the data and consequences we're observing in our state. I'm going to talk more specifically about extremes today. As context for today, I would just like to offer a word of thanks and perspective. This body that I'm with today is very much respected in my family. My great-great-grandfather pictured here, Ira Seely, was a member of the first Minnesota Territorial Legislature, as well as a member of the first state legislature. And as family genealogist, I have studied his life and also have been privy to read about the history of his work with the legislature. And it's been my perception as sort of a reader of Minnesota history that scientific knowledge, though important, it's also important to share in the context of our shared values. And so I would like to keep that frame of mind as we go through this morning and acknowledge what's going on in our state in terms of extremes.
Dr. Seely, we can see the resemblance.
My wife thinks he was more handsome than I am, but the three parameters we acknowledge, and not just myself, but the regional climate group here in the North Central region, that we widely acknowledge are changing significantly and pass most rigorous statistical tests for their significance are the temperatures, the water vapor in the atmosphere, and the variability change in our precipitation. I talked about those last Tuesday here, but I want to restate those again because, quite frankly, they all have implications on severe weather. The other feature that I didn't deal with last week, but I'm sure you've heard about, is the trends in our vulnerability from the standpoint of economic consequence of individual severe weather episodes and climate matters, whether it be a drought or wildfires or severe tornadoes or things of that nature. Nationwide, all of the statistics, and many of this was these statistics were shared with the Senate on Tuesday of this week, show an increasing trend. The economic consequence of these events appears to be literally costing us more dearly with each passing decade. The history in Minnesota is an interesting one. I serve on the University of Minnesota Extension Disaster Education Response Team, and have ever since I came to Minnesota in the 70s. In fact, my faculty position as a climate scientist, I'm your climate scientist because it was this body that created my faculty position following the drought of 1976. And I've given a chronology here of severe or extreme events and episodes that we as a community have had to respond to since I arrived in Minnesota. And you'll see a wide range here. Some of you probably vividly remember some of these individual events and episodes. The point is that we are impacted by a number of extremes, a wide range of extremes. This last year, as I mentioned on Tuesday of last week, was the second time in our history, only the second time in our history, that simultaneously on the Minnesota landscape we had counties declared for USDA federal disaster declarations, and at the same moment in time, we had counties on the Minnesota landscape declared by FEMA for federal flood disaster declarations. The only other year that's happened was 2007, but it happened again to us last year. And this is very disconcerting in my view, having studied Minnesota's climate and written about it all the way back to 1807. By the way, I'm revising my book of 2006 because we've set so many records since 2006. And so this is something that those of us that have worked in the business of climate science are concerned about because of what we're seeing in the frequency of occurrence of these extremes. Since the drought year of 1988, which, by the way, impacted us with well over $4 billion in economic consequence as a state, We've seen more intense thunderstorm rains, more flash floods, more spring snowmelt floods. Two different animals there, by the way. Spring snowmelt floods can be of extremely long duration, as they were at Fargo-Moorhead, 66 consecutive days above flood stage back in 2009, whereas flash floods are short-lived phenomena. More large hail, more tornadoes, tornado numbers are up on average, and more heat advisories. One thing going on from a pure scientific point of view that could be appreciated is just to describe what's going on in the lower level of our atmosphere, which we call the troposphere. The troposphere is the mixing layer of the atmosphere where all the heat and moisture are transferred. It's where all the cloud systems are. The jet stream is embedded in the top of the troposphere. It steers all the weather disturbances across our continent. It's a very important feature of our atmosphere. Studies by Ben Santer at Lawrence Livermore and other researchers have shown, as depicted in this graphic, that the height of the troposphere, the mixing depth of the atmosphere, is actually increasing across time. As the planet warms, the depth of the lower layer, we call the troposphere, expands. So you have a deeper mixing depth. On the far right side there, the only perturbations in the growth of the height of the troposphere that we detect are associated with massive volcanic eruptions that disturb the atmosphere so profoundly that they actually contracted the troposphere for a brief period of time. And Mount Pinatubo is the Philippine eruption in 1991, is the rightmost depicted one on that graph. What happens in the context of that is, as you increase the mixing volume of the atmosphere, you increase the potential for convection, for thunderstorm convection to occur, because it has a larger volume to operate in. Cloud tops can grow higher. Updrafts, downdrafts can be longer in length, and you can have more severe storms. In 2010, we led the nation in tornadoes with 113 tornadoes in our Minnesota landscape. Roughly 45 to 47 degrees north latitude. The first time in U.S. history that we have produced on our landscape more annual tornadoes than any other state. And depicted on the map here, we had 48 in one day. June 17th of 2010, we had 48 tornadoes across the state. Believe me, our weather service was extremely busy that day. The other feature that is evidence of the growing height of the troposphere is what's going on in our neighbor to the north, Canada. In Manitoba, depicted on the upper right of this graphic, is the first ever EF5 tornado detected in the nation of Canada. And it was Ely, Manitoba, back on June 22, 2007, associated with cloud tops that went to 54,000 feet. Not seen previously in the Canadian atmosphere. And then in the lower right, Churchill, Manitoba, again up at the shores of Hudson Bay, 59 degrees north latitude, again with more enhanced convection because of the deeper atmosphere, they experienced a 4-inch, their first ever measured 4-inch thunderstorm rain on August 24th, 2010. So the premise here is that as the troposphere grows in volume, it will become more capable of delivering severe convective weather, even at high latitude positions. There's a precipitation depiction, which I showed earlier, that shows how wet the state has become on average, with many years of recent decades exceeding the 75th percentile, and of course our wettest year in history being 2010. Our background normals have increased, as I showed earlier, site by site. If you tap our state database, you will find that the quantity shifts in our precipitation have ranged anywhere from 10% upward to as much as 30% upward in terms of our average annual precipitation amounts. But in the climate sciences, we pay more attention than just the quantity shifts. We pay attention to character shifts, type of precipitation, liquid versus frozen. And we're getting more liquid precipitation in the November through March period than we once did. Less frozen, more liquid. The intensity of that precipitation, how much we get per hour or per 30 minutes or what have you. The frequency, the actual number of events we measure in any one year. The seasonality shifts. We're getting some of our most intense rainfall events falling later on the calendar. Once upon a time, they almost always occurred in the months of May, June, July. Now we're getting them in August, September, and October. And then the relationships to landscape. So there's a lot of things in the climate business we have to pay attention to, not just the quantity shifts. Our National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration researchers tell us that the fractional contribution of thunderstorms has increased over the Great Lakes. That is, in their analysis, the more intense rainfalls are occurring in a manner that they represent a larger and larger fraction of our annual precipitation. That translates into higher spatial variability on the landscape, winners and losers, if you will. The disparity between those who get hit and those who don't grows. Also, it translates into amplified variation in our state's hydrologic features, lake levels, groundwater aquifers, stream volume flow, a number of other things. The depiction here of the St. Louis River in Carlton County simply shows that in the year 2012, they hit their all-time highest volumetric flow level ever measured, associated with the massive Duluth flash flood back in June. And then by fall, by the autumn season of 2012, they were near their all-time low, an expression of a 90-fold difference in the volume flow on the St. Louis River. And that's but one example of the variation on a Minnesota watershed. The historic drought frequency is changing. We've had severe to extreme drought 8 consecutive summers now in Minnesota since 2005, appearing somewhere on the landscape. So that drought has had to be dealt with in that manner somewhere in Minnesota every summer for 8 consecutive years. And we're quite concerned about this coming year in 2013 because we have 55 counties that carried over in severe drought from last year.
Dr. Seeley, some who missed the first one when you explained how is it you go from flood to drought, maybe just a word about that. I was looking at upcoming slides, and I don't see you addressing that. You talked about that in your first presentation.
Yes, good, very good question. Thank you. The nature of this change, this character change, has been associated with the fact that more of our annual precipitation comes from thunderstorms. Thunderstorms inherently bring high spatial variability. They don't cut a wide swath across the state. In fact, they cut rather narrow paths more often than not across the state. So they bring abundant precipitation to some areas, but those areas they miss then are entirely missed. So the disparity between the amounts of rainfall that fall on the Minnesota landscape when you're dominated by thunderstorms becomes a magnified disparity. Even within townships, I might mention, since we do this every year for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, even within townships, we have noted differences of 8, 9, and 10 inches in growing season rainfall across townships just because of the dominance of the thunderstorm change in our rainfall pattern. So that's why we're seeing this amplified variation appear. They are accounting for a higher and higher fraction of our annual precipitation.
And then just a word about soil moisture.
Well, and then that translates into amplified variation in soil moisture, what gets stored in the soil, what runs off. We all know a higher volume of rainfall will run off from a 4-inch rain rather than, say, a very mild half-inch rain or a 3/4-inch rain. Fractionally, you'll lose more of that in runoff because the soil infiltration rate can't tolerate 4 inches of rain. So that translates into amplified variability in soil moisture as it does our other surface hydrologic features. That's the point I was making that's evident in our data. As a result of the thunderstorm character, we've been hit by a number of very damaging flash floods in recent summers. The frequency of dealing with this has increased in my professional experience here in Minnesota, which is 35 years, and we're seeing that play out in a variety of ways in terms of damage to our infrastructure. It does, however, point to a startling feature of what goes around comes around. Our Minnesota history, if it tells us anything, tells us that what goes around comes around. In July of 1867, on the Chippewa and Palme de Terre watersheds in western Minnesota, we had the worst flash flood that's ever appeared in our history. 30 to 36 inches of rainfall in 30 hours. The as you can see here, the Chippewa River, those of you that have been out here probably been out in that area probably have noted that it's sometimes just a trickle, was 4 miles wide following this thunderstorm. The one and only measured rise of 12 feet on the upper Mississippi was associated with this thunderstorm. This thunderstorm approximates the hydrologic maximum 24-hour rainfall for the state of Minnesota, which is calculated at about 35 inches. So Mother Nature is capable of delivering more intensity than we have experienced in our lifetime. The upward trend in temperature I've already talked about, but the last point I'd like to make is the upward trend in dew point is driving a more frequent issuance of heat advisories and heat warnings. In our lifetime, we've seen many summers where the National Weather Service has had to put out a heat warning or heat advisory because of these high dew points. I think I've mentioned to you back in July of 2011, we were the hottest point on Earth with a heat index of 134 degrees at Moorhead, Minnesota. And in our experience here in Minnesota, almost all of our recent heat waves have been driven by dew point, not air temperature. We've had tropical-like air masses move this far north on the North American continent, settle over Minnesota, and inflate the heat index to intolerable levels, which has had health implications. All of those underlined years were years that impacted the livestock industry in this state. We actually had loss in the poultry industry that was substantial, and we also had some loss in our dairy herds in terms of aborted pregnancies and health issues with our dairy cows. So lastly, in terms of setting the table for further discussion this morning, the amplified variability of our surface water is evident in both the low and high flows. Both types of floods, spring snowmelt floods and flash floods, we are having to cope with more frequently as a community. Increased frequency of drought in evidence as well with agricultural, fire weather, and hydrologic implications. Impacts of increased frequency and magnitude associated with insured losses and infrastructure damages. Increased frequency of heat advisories and excessive heat warnings associated with our health care system has implications for that, as well as certainly our livestock producers. And our need to explore adaptation and mitigation strategies that make us more resilient and incentivize citizens to do so is a very pertinent and important manner for those of us, a matter to deal with for those of us that are studying our state's climate history. And those conclude my remarks, Representative Hausman. If I understand, we're going to have questions towards the end of the session. Is that correct?
Just to check, are you staying to the end?
Yes.
Okay. We would have just a few minutes, I think, because we're still within your time frame. So maybe we'll just, if there is, I think all of the other presentations are a bit shorter. So, yes. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Seeley, listening this morning to the radio, Salt Lake City, I believe, was having an issue with inversions. It's an ongoing problem there. Do we have any similar situations here in Minnesota?
I don't have the answer for that, Representative Torkelson. The fact of the matter is there is a perception that we're having more air quality spells where air quality is detrimental to our health, but I haven't studied that personally, and I don't know what the trends are here. Certainly, that needs to be looked at. I wasn't prepared to talk about air quality matters when I came this morning, so I don't have any data As you know, I'm kind of a data person. If I don't have data to fall back on, I'm not going to usually comment about anything. So I really don't know if there's a relationship going on like that, a distinct trend in our state, but it would be well worth looking at.
And Representative Torkelson, Representative Quinones has more information.
Our next hearing for our committee, we are going to be looking at air quality issues. So that will be our next Tuesday meeting. And this would be a good question for there.
Any further questions for Dr. Seeley? Thank you very much. And then we're inviting David Thornton forward. I think it looks like you're on the agenda twice. You're giving us a brief introduction, and then you'll return later for perhaps more extended comments. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I will be starting off giving you an introduction to how state agencies are beginning to respond to this information that you just heard today and also last week about how the climate in the state is changing and how it affects the way that we need to manage our programs at the agencies. Okay. I guess I need some help getting started here.
Do we have, who's our technical expert who can lend a hand there?
There we go. All right. So, as I said, I'm going to give you a brief introduction, and then we have some specific presentations from the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit about the programs at the Pollution Control Agency, and then I'll briefly summarize some of the other agencies, and then we'll have an opportunity to talk about next steps and answer some questions. So you've already heard that the climate here is changing in a number of different ways. And I think the bottom line for us is that climate change has the potential to disrupt ecological, economic, and social systems, and we need to figure out how to respond to that. So just quickly, extreme weather can include flash floods, seasonal floods, drought, wind and ice storms, extreme heat, wildfire, and other events that occur as a result of these weather episodes. Climate change adaptation is what folks generally use to refer to strategies, initiatives, and measures to help humans and natural systems thrive as our climate changes. And resiliency is the ability to bounce back and recover. And as people are talking about this nationwide, the use of the word adaptation is falling out of favor, and people like to use the word resiliency. I think it has a more positive sound. State agencies recognize the need to begin working together and looking at this in a systematic way. Back in 2009, we formed an interagency climate adaptation team that included representatives from agriculture, commerce, health, natural resources, pollution control, public safety, and transportation. This was an effort that was self-initiated by the agencies. We've since added the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Metropolitan Council just within the last year. We put together a report, which we essentially called a preliminary assessment in 2010. And that's on the Pollution Control Agency's website and may be available on other websites. And if you're interested, I can give you a link to that. We called it preliminary for a number of reasons. I think the whole notion of adapting to climate change is going to be an ongoing adaptive process. And there's much more that needs to be done. But basically, we started meeting to assess the vulnerabilities within the state and work together in developing responses. I mentioned the 2010 report. The major conclusions that we reached at that point in time was that spring flooding and flash flooding are probably the greatest near-term threats that we have in Minnesota, and that current regional climate forecasts are imprecise, and we need to try to find out a way to improve the accuracy of those so that we can better respond. We also concluded that we needed to keep working together to collect environmental data and develop responses. Our 2013 work plan for this coming year, we intend to update the report that we produced in 2010, continue to identify collaborative opportunities, and in particular, we believe that we need to start interacting with local units of government. We want to continue coordinating with other states and federal government and tracking developments, particularly in the science and as data becomes available. I'll mention more on this later, but we're all anxiously awaiting the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's new report that they're going to be putting out soon that updates all of the precipitation frequency and intensity information for a number of Midwestern states, including Minnesota, and it will be this information that we start gearing a lot of our responses towards. And then before we move to the Department of Natural Resources, just very briefly, a number of other states are engaged in similar activities. Some are more formal than others. This map shows you the states that have some level of adaptation planning underway right now. It's most heavily present in states that have coastal areas because of the concerns about sea level increase and the potential devastation that that could bring and the extreme costs associated with it. But as you can also see, there are a number of other states involved. Some had legislation that required some level of risk assessment, including in some cases the creation of blue ribbon panels. Others started working as a result of executive orders, and then a few started, as we did, in a more of a bottoms-up approach, like we've taken here. But as I said, adaptation plans are always in progress and adapting. So next, Department of Natural Resources.
And moving on then to the Department of Natural Resources, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dave Shedd. I'm Deputy Commissioner at Department of Natural Resources. You know, the challenges we face in managing natural resources in the face of changing climate and some of these extreme weather events is probably the most daunting challenge that we've ever faced, in large part because of the uncertainty here, not so much in terms of how climate is changing. I think, as Dr. Seeley said, we are getting a much more certain feel for how our climate is changing and how weather events are happening here in the state. But I think the uncertainty comes with how our natural resources, these natural systems, respond to some of these changes and what we might do as natural resource managers to respond to some of those changes. We really are facing some uncharted territory here, and all of us are learning together as we try to deal with these challenges. Because of the work we do, and we've got staff all around the state, our staff are often the first ones to actually see and respond to the effects of some of these extreme weather events. They're on the ground, they're responding and assisting with recovery efforts. Also, as a result of a lot of our monitoring programs, we are actually the first to observe and actually see some of the long-term changes that are occurring with natural resources as a result of the more gradual changes in climate. So what I thought I'd do today is give a brief overview with a few case examples or case studies that illustrate how we're preparing for some of these changes, how we're trying to better understand what's happening out on the landscape and how we might respond to some of these extreme weather events. First of all, there's a lot of information floating around out there, both in terms of changing climate, but also in terms of how we might manage natural resources with a changing climate. And so we thought it was important to kind of pull all that information together in a concise way for our staff. And we did develop a report last year called Climate Change and Renewable Energy Management Foundations. It has a real nice assessment of the climate science, especially as it relates to natural resource management, what we think might be happening as far as impacts to natural resources, and some of the management options that we might want to consider in the face of some of these changes. We worked with not only our own staff, but also some of the academic institutions, experts from other agencies and other states in compiling this. And it's a really nice, concise document. I encourage you to take a look at it. We've got a few copies here, and also it's available at that web link there at the top of the slide if you'd like to go out on our website and take a look at it. So what I thought I'd do is walk through three case studies or examples here to illustrate climate impacts and some of the on-the-ground actions that we're taking, both in response to some of these impacts, but to better prepare for some of these impacts. So we'll talk a little bit about floods and drought, forest blowdown or wind throw, and fire events, and then some impacts that we're seeing to cold water fisheries. And one of the common themes that you will see as I go through these case studies is the need to be proactive in preparing for some of these climate impacts by maintaining and restoring healthy landscapes. We know that healthy systems that are connected, that are well functioning, are more resilient to these changes. And so, building that resiliency in, we think these systems can better adapt and better recover as a result of some of these extreme events. What we've learned about climate change is that it really amplifies existing stressors. So if you have fragmented habitats, if you've got poor water quality, if you've got invasive species, climate change kind of amplifies the impact of those problems out in the systems and makes those problems even worse. And so building healthier systems will help resiliency, help with recovery. First of all, extreme rainfall events. Dr. Seely talked about this a bit. The graph at the top here is some information that our climatology office and the department pulled together, and it shows the number of 6-inch rains covering more than 1,000 square miles dating back to 1860. And you can see that since 2000, the number of those large-scale, heavy rainfall events has significantly increased, and that has real obvious implications for natural systems. The rain event in southeastern Minnesota in 2007, $157 million in damage. The more recent event in northeastern Minnesota in 2012, over $100 million of damage. This shows some of the impacts from that 2012 event up around Jay Cook State Park. You've probably heard a lot about that and the swinging bridge and so forth. Basically, the larger the dot, the more extreme the damage. But all told, just in this one area here, $42 million of damage, $40 million alone to address washouts and problems on Highway 210. As it passes through the park, an additional $2 million to the park itself. So these extreme weather events are expensive and difficult to respond to. We do have some programs in place and have taken some actions to build resilience to some of these flood events. The photo here shows the city of Montevideo in 1997. That city experienced a flood event. As a result of that, we were provided some money to through our flood damage mitigation program to buy out homes in the floodplain. Just 3 years later, in 2000, this flood event occurred, and those red dots are places where homes existed in 1997 that were bought out, and obviously, the amount of damage was reduced as a result of that state investment. In Austin, we've spent more than $13 million, federal, state, and local funds, to remove homes from flood-prone areas. And in 2010 alone, this resulted in savings of more than $7 million. And according to FEMA, for every dollar that we invest in these kind of mitigation efforts, we get a $4 return. So So we have spent a lot of money doing this kind of work over the years. We think it's a wise investment, but it's not our only strategy. We also need to try to hold the water on the land, try to slow down that water, and reduce the impacts of some of these floods. And so restoring wetlands, putting buffers on the landscape, restoring grasslands is also an important strategy. Unfortunately, we're kind of going backwards in that regard, especially in agricultural portions of the state. A recent report from the Environmental Working Group indicated that since 2008, here in Minnesota, we've lost more than 1.3 million acres of grasslands and wetlands. And that's very alarming for many reasons, but it will exacerbate some of these flood damage issues.
I'm going to break from my earlier thing, holding questions, because we are moving along reasonably well, and Representative Mahoney has a question probably to this, this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is in the context that we spend a lot of money on flood relief and flood repair. And I'm looking at the picture that you've got up there. First question, is that a picture during the flood or after or before?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's during the 2000 flood.
So, thank you, Madam Chair, sir. There seems to be other homes within the area of the flood that are flooded. Mm-hmm. Did we have to spend money to repair those homes that were flooded after you offered the buyout?
Mr. Shedd.
Madam Chair, Representative, typically no. The state funds that we receive anyway are generally used to mitigate, to buy out homes. It's voluntary. Landowners aren't required to participate in these programs. If they choose not to, they do so at their own risk, and would be wise to seek out flood insurance, I think.
So. Madam Chair, one final question. So I'll rephrase the question. Mm-hmm. Was anyone's tax dollars used to mitigate the flood, the effects of the flood for those homeowners that were offered a buyout?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not absolutely certain about that. For whenever we have these flood events, legislators, federal agencies will provide aid in various forms. I'm not sure for this specific event if there was any aid, but we can get that information for you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shedd, I've heard this figure batted around, this 1.3, 1.4 million acre figure that came mm-hmm. from the Environmental Working Group.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done anything to verify that figure is valid?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, we have not. I know Environmental Working Groups are a very credible agency, but I'm relaying information that was provided actually at our recent roundtable event first weekend in January.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would argue that Environmental Group Working Group is not credible, and this mm-hmm. figure is inaccurate.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, it may be, but we are seeing some real changes out in the agricultural landscape, especially with Conservation Reserve Program lands, with the strong markets for corn and soybeans and so forth. It's very, very challenging for a lot of farmers to continue to participate in conservation programs, looking at just economic realities here. And so we have seen a lot of loss of CRP lands out on the landscape, and I think everybody that's involved with conservation is predicting that we're going to see hundreds of thousands of acres continue to be lost.
Representative Torkelson, I think we're going to perhaps work on getting some better figures. You've raised that issue, and so it's something we'll put on the agenda. And then one more, Representative Fabian, and then we'll have to have you finish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shedd, you mentioned that you think that it's important to hold water on the land. In my district in 2002, obviously we had a flood event up there in Roseau County and mm-hmm. in areas to the east in Representative Erickson's district. Currently we are working to develop a new plan for the LUP lands. in the Beltrami Island State Forest, which is the headwaters for the Rosa River and also the Ward River. I'm disappointed in that there has been, I'll say, resistance within the agency to holding water on the land, on those LUP lands. And I hope that in light of your testimony here today, that we use that area to do some retention areas. The Red River Water Management Board has a goal for all of the different watershed districts within the Red River Basin to hold back 20% of the peak flow. About 30% of the land in my district is owned by the state of Minnesota. It's important to me that the state agency does their share of holding back the 20%, and I know we have made some gains in that area. I appreciate that, but this LUP project and the proposal is very, very critical in my district. The LUP plan, as it's designed, simply requires the approval of the commissioner and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to do that. To the best of my knowledge, there's not much other oversight in that process. I hope that we can continue to have discussions about that. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shad, you've got a number of slides yet, so we won't interrupt you again.
Okay. Moving on to drought, as Dr. Seeley said, we've got widespread drought in the state as we speak here, and drought has profound impacts on natural resources, groundwater, lake levels, and stream levels. It stresses forests and impacts forest productivity. It increases wildfire hazards, stresses wildlife, and so forth. Prairie wetlands are especially sensitive to drought. And the graph at the bottom merely shows that the number of breeding ducks closely tracks the number of wetlands out on the landscape. And as wetlands drop, duck populations drop, and this would be true for shorebirds and other wetland-dependent wildlife species as well. One of the ways that we can build resilience to both drought and some of these big flood events are by restoring some of these natural systems, and the Prairie Conservation Plan that was recently signed by a number of conservation agencies and organizations is a good example of how we might approach that. Rather than kind of scattergunning conservation out across the landscape, if we can focus our efforts collectively in some of these core areas, some of these corridors to build systems that are more resilient, to connect those resilient systems with each other so that species can move and adapt as climate changes is a good investment. And we have made significant investments in protection of existing prairies and restoration of grasslands, and our plan moving forward is to do that in a more focused and collaborative way. Shift now into forest landscapes and talk a little bit about blowdown or wind throw and fire. And the two examples here, the 1999 blowdown in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area mm-hmm. Wilderness, nearly 500,000 acres impacted by that. Since 2006, we've had over 200,000 acres burned, much of that in very large scale and major events. The largest was the 2011 Pagami Creek fire, which consumed 90,000 acres, but many other smaller events. A specific example of blowdown occurred up near St. Croix State Park in early July of 2011, and a lot of us in DNR remember this because it happened right in the middle of the state government shutdown in 2011. All told, that event impacted 185,000 acres, more than half of that, 97,000 acres, state land within the St. Croix State Park and nearby state forest. We had about 200 miles of roads and trails damaged, 74 buildings either damaged or destroyed, several campgrounds were unusable for most of the summer. And unfortunately, this followed two smaller events in 2005 and 2008 in this same area, blowdown events. And so as our staff were working very hard to just kind of recover from trying to manage the effects of those two earlier events, they got kind of overwhelmed with this next really big one. Consequences of this particular blowdown, we see increased risk for wildfire with all that dead wood laying down on the ground. It makes our forest more susceptible for insect and disease, and it creates some real challenges as far as forest regeneration. In this one single event, we offered for sale 262,000 cords for salvage. And just to put that into context, our total harvest of wood from all state lands across the state annually is about 800,000 cords. So just from this one event, that represented about a third of our annual state timber harvest from state lands. Because we had to sell that timber at a discount because of the difficulty in getting it and harvesting that timber, we estimate we lost more than $4 million in revenue. But it was important that we get in and salvage that timber. We incurred about $1.5 million in cleanup and facility repair costs, and obviously it took time away from other important and pressing duties. Now, as we look at recovery of that area, we are considering a changing climate, and so we are actually looking at restoring, especially St. Croix State Park, towards more of an open savanna type landscape. And we're doing this with a tool that we have developed in recent years called the Ecologic Classification System, or ECS. ECS basically allows us to match species, match habitats to sites based on soil and vegetation and climate and so forth. And so by actually basing restoration decisions on ECS, we are creating a more resilient community, a community that in the future will be better able to withstand both the gradual impacts of a changing climate, but also some of these more severe weather events. The second strategy that we use in building resilience in forested landscapes, and in our forest, we largely have a fairly intact and functioning natural resource system, and our goal there is basically to do what we can to try to protect that and protect existing connections. And one way we do that protection is through conservation easements. The example here is the large Upper Mississippi Forest Project in Itasca and surrounding counties completed in 2010. The orange are what are currently Blandon County company lands that we took a conservation easement on, protecting them from future development and fragmentation, linking up other public lands and creating an intact and connected forest and protecting that into the future. The last example I'd like to touch on is one associated with cold water fishery. And I want to just talk a little bit about a species called Cisco, and it's maybe one that you're not very familiar with, but it's very, very important. This is a cold water species. It exists where we've got good water quality and cold water, and we are seeing significant declines. In fact, a 42% decline in Cisco populations since 1970, and we have seen Cisco disappear completely from some of our warmer and shallower lakes. Cisco are an important part of the food web within a lot of these lake systems. They're an important prey fish for some of our larger species, and so we are taking some extra steps to monitor status of Cisco. We have identified a series of lakes that we believe, even with a warmer climate, will continue to provide habitat for Cisco. And we are developing plans, working with public landowners, to make sure that the watersheds for these really key lakes, these refuge lakes for Cisco, are protected. We can maintain good water quality and hopefully ensure survival of Cisco, even with a warmer climate, even in the face of some of these more extreme weather events. So to conclude, our strategy to build resilience here with these natural systems, our fundamental strategy is really to increase the size, connectivity, and quality of our forests, our prairies and grasslands, and our wetlands, create more healthy lands out there. Second, we need to strengthen, redesign, and relocate some of our infrastructure using new science and new approaches, dikes and dams, for example, but also wetlands and so forth. And then finally, we need to work together, especially when it comes to monitoring. We really need to understand what is happening out on the landscape, how these systems are responding, and how some of our management efforts are kind of offsetting the impacts of some of these extreme weather events and changing climate. So with that, I will turn it over to Linda Bremer from the Department of Health.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Bremer. I'm the Division Director of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. And so you've heard Dr. Seeley's climatological data, you've heard some ecological data, and so I'd like to talk about the population effects of climate change. And not give the DNR's talk again. Okay. So this is our logic model that we look at from the public health perspective. In the first area, you see increased temperature, increased humidity, extreme precipitation. Those are the observed climate changes. Then we look at the likely events that you've heard. Extreme heat, air pollutants, ozone, longer growing season, severe storms, changes in environment habitat, flooding, drought, wildfires. So then we look at the population effects and population outcomes. That's the last piece of this chart. The effects are heat-related illness and death, cardiovascular disease and stroke, respiratory illness, allergies, injuries, drowning, infectious disease, stress and mental illness, and displacement. And what I'd like to cover are just a few examples of what the health department, what data we combine with the climatological and ecological data would be. So the first example is the distribution of Lyme disease, and this is cases by county of residence. We know tick-borne disease outbreaks risk can be impacted by the abundance and distribution of ticks, the percentage of ticks that are infected with disease agents, the abundance and distribution of animals that carry ticks, the presence of suitable habitat for ticks, and people's behaviors that bring them into contact with infected ticks. Say it's too hot in your house and you want to take a walk in a nice field. And you might be doing that more frequently than if you had air conditioning and didn't want to go outside. So what we're looking at here is the change, basically, the incidence rate from our Division of Infectious Disease, looking at how it's expanded just in 14, 15 years. And an anecdotal story about that is when I started at the health department in the year 2000, we only gave our field inspectors in Fergus Falls and Bemidji, they had Lyme disease safety training, you know, tuck your pants in your socks and make sure you're all covered up. That was about 2000. And so look at the zone in the year 2000 and look where it is now. One of the things I have to point out, one of the limitations of health data is we can tell you what happened. Sometimes we're about 2 years behind because we collect the data after things have happened and make recommendations based on that. So Minnesota's Health Department's tick-borne disease monitoring system is able to detect an increase in number of people contracting Lyme disease and the change in the geographic distribution of high-risk areas. MDH has developed prevention strategies, including educational messages for the public on when and where they're at risk and how to protect themselves from tick-borne diseases. However, we don't know how fast Lyme disease or other tick-borne diseases will spread and how much of the spread is related to climate change. We also do not have adequate resources to perform field studies for new or emerging diseases that may be carried by ticks. This requires collecting tick samples throughout the states and testing them for diseases. You might have seen pictures of this collection. It's literally people walking through fields with nets, seeing what insects they can gather, and then examining what they collected. So the main points of this are Lyme disease and other tick-borne disease cases are increasing and are being reported. Climate variables such as temperature and humidity are critical for tick survival, but we don't know how much of the climate variables impact the changes we are seeing. MDH suspects that climate changes will change the number of cases, the kinds of tick-borne diseases, and the geographic distribution of the diseases in Minnesota. The next is an example of extreme heat, emergency department visits. We worked closely with the city of Minneapolis on some of our extreme heat responses. This chart shows the age-adjusted rate of emergency department visits due to heat with average summer temperatures. Higher summer temperatures correlated with higher numbers of people who visited emergency departments for heat-related illnesses. For 2001, over 1,000 people visited emergency departments due to heat. And the reason this is age-adjusted is so that it drops out your normal group of people who, like older people who would come to the emergency room. So this is trying to weed out exactly which visits to the emergency room are connected with the heat. In July 2012, that was the second warmest July on record in the Twin Cities. On July 4th, the temperature hit 101 degrees with a dew point of 77 degrees. Temperatures continued to stay in the upper 90s and 100s for several days, reaching a record high of 102 on July 6th. The Minneapolis Department of Health responded to the extreme heat by implementing their heat annex plan. Many cities and counties in Minnesota do not have a heat response plan, but we have created a toolkit, and we are working with locals to get them better set to respond to these extreme heat events. The health department provided information on open public sites people could visit to cool off, ensured that the radio and TV provided tips on how to stay cool, including messages on checking, you might remember this, checking your older neighbors, people who live alone to make sure they were okay, and contacted their email and phone networks of community-based organizations that work with individuals who are more susceptible to heat. The Minneapolis Health Department used maps that, in cooperation that the health department staff put together to target where vulnerable groups might be living with little or no air conditioning. And those maps are available on our website, and then we share the Excel spreadsheets with the locals if they want to do more detailed planning. That's, I believe, the next slide. That one's in a handout, I'm sorry. That you might have. It's a GIS map that shows it looks like this. Do you have that one? No. There are copies up here. And so this, we tried to predict where the percentage of elderly living alone would be located, and obviously on a state level this isn't very helpful, but we do have the data behind that, and we've got several layers of data: ages of residents, young and old, the income levels, and various other parameters. So with that, we felt, unfortunately, when we work on these extreme heat events, again, the data is not always standardized. We do have a team of people who are working together to try and standardize, say, when there's an emergency management call and somebody's taken to the hospital, if we could get some codes that reflect heat stress, then we could better collect this information and help standardize a monitoring system. So the health department has developed a toolkit for planning and extreme heat events to help local public health and emergency managers prepare for extreme heat events. We've also provided these mapping services to several cities and counties to help their planning efforts, but we don't have an information system that can tell us in real time who and how many people are suffering from the heat. As you can imagine, we get quite a few calls from the media saying how many deaths have there been from the heat. Well, it's not anything that's coded, and actually it takes a person to go look at death records to come up with those. So once again, that's one where we can probably tell you 2 years later how many people died from the heat event. But I think in terms, the important message is, in terms of response, it's those messages while the heat event is going on. It's not, you know, how many people died today. I think that's it's better to take the preventive route. So basically, this is the Minnesota Climate and Health Program. This slide makes it seem like it's much grander than it actually is. It's been funded by the Centers for Disease Control on a 3-year grant, and we're coming this August will be the end of our grant from the CDC. We do intend to apply. It's been a planning grant, so we've put together, under education, we've put together training modules that locals can use, and we've been working more closely with local public health. All of this stuff is available on our website, and we do intend to apply to the Centers for Disease Control for implementation funding in the next stage. And with that, I will pass it off to Greta Gauthier from the Department of Agriculture.
The next three slides from the Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greta Gauthier. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Like the Department of Health, the Department of Agriculture is involved in these extreme weather events, sometimes immediately prior or during or immediately after. Prior or during in the case of floods that we know are coming, and after also for floods, tornadoes, and droughts a little bit different, but I will talk about that in a minute. We have about 400 employees in our department, and about 150 of them are inspectors that are out across the state. They work from home offices or their car, and they inspect things like food and feed and ag chemicals and grocery stores and food processing operations. And so what happens when there is a emergency natural weather disaster is we deploy our inspectors immediately across the state or to wherever the location of the flood or tornado, et cetera. So these are some of the ways that our inspectors are able to assist in the very immediate situation. Grocery stores, we help them salvage and toss, make those decisions for food that's been damaged. Our retail food inspectors will come back again and again and again to help the stores get it properly cleaned up and ready to do business. Feed storage, dairy farms, with the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health, we also address any chemical spills that may occur. We also are sampling seed and sludge and grains and water to assess damage and to make determinations about what needs to be disposed of and then helping with that disposal. And also we work with counties in curbside collection of household hazardous waste. The Department of Agriculture has the authority from the 1989 groundwater law to collect waste ag and non-ag pesticide. So an example of a non-ag pesticide would be a structural pesticide, for example, to fight bed bugs. So what we will do in the event of a flood, for example, is work with the counties to accelerate the collection of anything that we know that might be in the path of the flood and to get it to a higher ground or out of harm's way. We also facilitate or help farms and ag businesses remove debris, clean up, repair, and rebuild. For example, last year during the special legislative session, there was an appropriation made for disaster recovery for farmers. We make those grants, set criteria, and so forth to individual farmers. We alone for the floods in Duluth last year calculated a non-insurance damage amount of about $2.5 million. That's just from our our work in the relief program. The Rural Finance Authority is a separate entity within the department that was set up after the 1988 drought. And one of the tools that the Finance Authority has, it does low-interest loans on a partnership basis with local banks. One of the tools is a disaster recovery loan that can be used to rebuild barns or other facilities on site. It also can be used to repair damaged entryways to fields that are flooded. And we also have the Minnesota Farmer Assistance Network. And this is kind of a one-stop number, toll-free, that farmers can call for any kind of assistance they need, whether it is financial, whether it is mental health, whatever we can do to connect farmers with the services that they might require. Our goal is to get the ag and food sector back in business and also, of course, to maintain food safety and the integrity of the food supply. We also help formulate recovery plans. We like to have those in place, be you know, at all times before these incidents strike. And we, like I said earlier, we will do multiple inspections of processing facilities, dairy farms, grocery stores, to help them recover, clean up, remove the damaged materials, and get back in business as soon as possible. Again, we want to make sure that the integrity of the food supply is intact. I will mention one other thing that our department has been starting to look at more, and that is invasive terrestrial species. As you know, the DNR has the aquatics, but we have the plants. And so a couple things that our folks in our plant protection area are seeing are that some pests are becoming established further north due to differences in temperature, so forth. Examples of these might be potato blight, kudzu, mountain pine beetle. We're also seeing another category that are blown our way every spring anyway, but they're arriving earlier in Minnesota because spring is arriving earlier, and those might include aphids and cutworms, soybean rust or wheat rust. And then we're also seeing pests that are able to have more generations per year due to the longer summers we've been seeing. And that might include the European corn borer. There's another one, the brown marmorated stink bug. And a lot of these have tremendous impact on crop production, on livestock. We also recently received a LCCMR grant to start looking at five plant species that we see on the horizon that we know are going to be problems in Minnesota. One of them is called Dalmatian toadflax, and it overtakes grasslands and pastures, and there will be livestock implications. We're seeing that up in northwest Minnesota. Another one is Grecian foxglove, which is already established in Washington County, and that is highly toxic to humans and livestock and to wildlife. So we are trying to get ahead of the curve on these with invasive species. Our goal is always to slow the spread, to allow more time for adjustment, both of our ag industries, our nursery industry, and so forth. And I will say one other thing about drought. We have done a lot to try to coordinate for farmers, too. We have a hotline on our website, places where people have been able to go, the Hay Exchange at the University of Minnesota Extension. We have a connection to that. We don't provide drought services as much as the USDA does, but we link farmers as much as possible to those resources. Madam Chair, I also am the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. And the Board of Animal Health also plays a role when there is an extreme weather event. As Dr. Seeley noted, there have been increased animal deaths due to some of these extreme heat situations and floods and tornado. The Board of Animal Health is charged with carcass disposal responsibility. And the Board of Animal Health is the lead, and it partners with the MPCA. The board goes on, we have veterinarians statewide out in the field will go on site to offer assistance and direction. We prefer, as a method of disposal, composting is the most preferred, but It varies by species and situation. Biosecurity is always a top priority. In the heat event of 2011, we did have hundreds of livestock perish in western Minnesota, so there were actions that had to be taken at that time in order to find a way to dispose of those carcasses. And by the time composting was not an issue, so they had to be taken to a rendering plant. There are only two rendering plants in Minnesota, and at the time during that heat, extreme heat in the summer of 11, those plants were full up, so were all the plants in Iowa, and South Dakota doesn't have any rendering plants. We eventually hooked those producers up with a rendering plant in Wisconsin that was able to properly dispose of those carcasses. Education and outreach is a key effort on our part to make sure that livestock producers, animal agriculture, farmers have an emergency response plan in place so that they know what they need to do to compost and so forth. We do work with the University of Minnesota and with cattlemen's and other agricultural stakeholders in putting those plans together. We also go out and present information statewide. So our response is not as much tied up with science on the landscape as it is with dealing with the aftermath.
Thank you. And we have one final speaker, and then we'll wrap up with we have a few members who have questions. Welcome back, Mr. Thornton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on at the PCA and also a few other agencies. We are obviously most concerned with water quality, waste management, and air quality as it relates to climate change. Particularly important is our wastewater infrastructure, which is vulnerable from impacts from flooding and excessive flows into the sanitary collection system during extreme precipitation events. Our wastewater treatment facilities are designed to our siting requirements, which make them which require them to be fully operational for 25-year floods and be protected from physical damage from to 100-year floods. The trouble is that what we used to think was a 25-year flood or a 100-year flood is changing. As I mentioned earlier, we're all waiting for this new NOAA Atlas 14 report, which is going to change the understanding of what a 25-year flood, 100-year flood, and other kinds of extreme precipitation events are going to be. So this is something that we're going to have to look at and go back and evaluate things with. This is the Rushford, Minnesota treatment plant in 07. Obviously, it was flooded. After some consideration, it was particularly of the cost to move the plant. Some minor changes were made to try to further protect it from flooding. So one of the things that we're going to have to do is go back and evaluate the existing infrastructure and see where some of the most risky locations are and evaluate options for addressing additional flooding concerns in the future. Obviously, when you have a flood, you have plant bypasses. The floods in northeastern Minnesota resulted in bypasses and damage to all of these treatment systems. The total damage for that flood last summer was just to the wastewater infrastructure was $8.5 million. There are other things to consider, the possibility of wastewater reuse when we have drought, infrastructure improvements for high rainfall, and again, we need to monitor changes in flood plan maps and precipitation and go back and review the infrastructure that we have. The stormwater infrastructure involves culverts, storm sewers, ponds, and other devices. If they're inadequate, as this one was in Duluth, it can result in a bridge washout and other types of things. It can also result in pollution as excessive runoff gets into our water bodies, like this picture from Lake Superior shows. And again, the stormwater infrastructure is something that we need to go back and evaluate when we get the new information from the National Atmospheric and Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Again, we'll be using this data to review our infrastructure and risk potential and evaluate things from there. Our solid waste infrastructure mainly is deals with the large quantities of debris that we see after floods and windstorms. We need to ensure that we're prepared to handle this excess debris, and that's what we're trying to address. There's as you can see, this flood resulted in a lot of damage to structures, and again, in Rushford, a large amount of debris was generated as a result of the flood. And then, as an example, in northeast Minnesota last summer, Carlton County alone generated 3,100 tons of debris as a result of that flood, and that's compared to their annual amount of waste that they generate, which is 3,700 tons. So within just one storm, they created as much waste as they almost create in an entire year. So this is something that we also have to be concerned about. I'm going to move along. Air quality, you'll hear more about that on Tuesday. But climate change has the high probability of degrading air quality, especially fine particulate matter, ozone, and visibility. And some of the concerns that we have are increased federal regulation, the costs of increased federal regulation, public health impacts, and such. Briefly, I will talk about some of the things that other agencies are doing. There's a lot that could be discussed, and we're not going to have time to do that here today, but I wanted to give you some highlights. The Department of Transportation obviously has a lot of infrastructure out there in the state, and there's the potential for some vulnerability. They have some bond money that they're using to fund projects to ensure sustainability of flood-prone highways. They've recently applied to FHWA for a pilot project to assess transportation infrastructure and vulnerability. And as all of us are, they're waiting for NOAA to update hydrographs. They're developing some flood-tolerant and drought-tolerant seeds mixtures, adapting stormwater design, and researching natural flocculants. And this is just an example of some drought-tolerant sod and seed mix. The green strip on the right is the drought tolerant, and the dead strip on the left, or excuse me, on the right side of the bicycle path is the normal seed mixture, which didn't make it. Department of Commerce, Division of Energy Resources, taking steps to improve the resiliency of our energy system and to improve performance and restoration of services after extreme events. It's one of the major activities that they have underway related to climate change. Their insurance division is engaging on how climate change is impacting the insurance market, and they have a response team to help with claims after events. The Board of Water and Soil Resources developing lots of efforts to help with wetland restoration, which absorbs flood waters and helps recharge groundwater, and a number of other activities that help keep water on the land. You've heard about that from a number of the speakers. This is an example of some of the kind of things that they've been doing, and this one is a success story. They funded a project to stabilize the stream bank of the Knife River near Two Harbors using woody materials and native plantings to protect against erosion. And the efforts were successful because when the flood last year occurred, there was very little damage to this stretch of the Knife River. So the efforts can be successful if we're able to make them. The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, or these are the boots on the ground first responders to emergencies. And I think the main thing that I'll say here is that they are building in the awareness of climate change and adaptation into their state all-hazard mitigation plan. So they're trying to familiarize people within their department and local responders to the need that they should have adequate resources and take mitigative measures. The Metropolitan Council manages a lot of infrastructure here in the Twin Cities, including our wastewater treatment system, and they've been at the forefront of making sure that that system is protected and resilient in the face of flooding. They also manage a lot of land in the case of the regional parks and the Metro Transit Authority, and they've been very innovative in developing ways to deal with stormwater and runoff and those sorts of things. That was just a very quick overview of a number of other agencies. I'm going to conclude with a few brief comments about next steps. I mentioned that we want to continue our interagency collaboration. We want to pursue all opportunities for federal funding. You've heard of a few federal grants that different agencies have obtained and have been helpful. We believe that we really need to start engaging more with local units of government and stakeholders and addressing the data gaps that we have. In particular, I've mentioned it once or several times. I'm going to mention it one more time. It's very crucial that we get this new NOAA information about precipitation so we can begin building that into our planning process. So as we move on, a lot of adapting to climate change is adapting the way that we do our existing businesses, operate our existing programs, and manage our resources to account for how the climate is changing. So a lot of it is on us to change the way that we're managing our business and state agencies. And we're beginning to do that, and we see this as an ongoing process. We have folks from all of the agencies mentioned here to help answer questions. And if we don't have time to get to your questions, please contact us individually, and we'd be more than happy to talk to you. Before I stop, I would like to acknowledge Paul Moss of our staff at the PCA, who helped coordinate this presentation and put all of the materials together.
Thank you so much. Very helpful. I have a huge list of questions here, but just for members of Capital Investment, I would like to let you know that those of us on Environment, Ag, and Natural Resources Finance have held two hearings on groundwater. And one of the things that we're seeing is that the drought we're in is exposing some real vulnerabilities to the availability of water. So that's another response that we are going to have to concentrate on, and we will, and I expect we're going to have more times to share back and forth between these committees. But with that, I do have a list, and we'll try to go very fast because members respect that there's a long list. Representative Kahn.
Yes. One of the things that came up again and again, I think, has to deal with the issue of information management. And how is information management going and information coordination? For example, I think, Mr. Thornton, you mentioned the PCA website. Does that connect now to everyone else's website? And how specifically is the new arrangement with whether we're calling it OET or MINUTE or whatever it's being called these days working?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, that's a great question. I think that's something that we need to take up and discuss further with our interagency group. We're sharing a lot of the data that we're collecting at lower levels, but there hasn't been a whole lot of information that has gone out for average citizens, stakeholders, and local units of government. And that's one of the things that I think we need to focus on as we move ahead.
Because I understood that some of the flood management in the last, I think it was in the last biennium, was really helped here because we were able to get out information about what was coming and what needed to be done. And I just want to know how we're proceeding in that way. And one other very quick one is Mr. Shad talked about the problems that occurred during the shutdown. How is that exacerbated by the fact that we were in shutdown mode, or was that because this was such an emergency, did the shutdown just not exist for those, for dealing with those problems?
Madam Chair, very briefly, we were able to define that as an emergency, bring back staff that had been laid off, some chainsaw crews and that kind of thing for kind of immediate relief, rescuing people and so forth, and then brought back a few people to just start the initial planning. So it slowed our response down, that was for sure, because we basically didn't have anybody out on the ground when that storm hit.
Thank you. Representative Moline?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I actually have a question for Representative Hausman or Representative Wagenius regarding, you know, first of all, thanks to the presenters and thanks to the chairs for having this. This has been really informational and important, and I hope that we're able to come together with some solutions. Of course, to get to those solutions, we need to know the ultimate cause of some of these problems, and my question is more along the lines of, will we be having a hearing either in this committee or Representative Wagenius in your committee on some of the actual causes of climate change? And one specific thing that I'm really interested in finding out more data on is the impact that our global economy has on climate change. We, of course, import so many goods into our country, and we're often getting them from countries that have little to no environmental standards. And then, of course, you know, all the emissions and pollutants that are involved in transporting them here to our country. So I'm wondering if we're going to be looking at that more, and if we're going to be hearing more on the actual causes of climate change.
And just speaking for capital investment, Jenny Nash and I, as anything related to infrastructure, we've been sort of circling and making notes to each other to see what additional follow-up we might do. So maybe by our next meeting we'll have some sense of where we'll go with the hearing.
Thanks for bringing that up. Representative John Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairs. And I agree with Representative Moline. This has really been an important and comprehensive and, but also concerning presentation, so thank you for having it. If members, if you'll refer back to page 14, I'll just make a real quick comment on page 14, and I know Representative Detmer will join me in this, I think. And Ms. Broomer, I'm going to ask you a question here in just a minute, but members, if you look at page 14, in the last four, and I'm talking about Lyme disease, in the last 14 to 17 years, you can see the spread of Lyme disease in the state of Minnesota, and you know, Ms. Broomer, you these are reported cases of Lyme disease. Is that correct,
Madam Chair, Representative Ward? Yes, that's correct.
And is it not true that there are far greater unreported cases of Lyme disease?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward? Yes, I would. Yes.
So
yes,
members,
they all don't get reported.
And one final question. So. Based on this climate report today that we've heard, Ms. Broomer, would you then say that the spread of Lyme disease will continue in this kind of pattern?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Ward, yes.
The likelihood.
Yes.
The likelihood. So, members,
the short answer is yes.
You know, members, as we visit about Lyme, and we've talked about infrastructure, we've talked about habitat, and we're talking about a personal a disease here as well, an infectious disease here as well. So, you know, I would encourage all of us to make sure that on the personal level we address these concerns and issues as well. So I just thank you for that. That input.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson, you're next.
Pass.
I'm sorry. Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Yeah, a quick one. Thanks, Madam Chair. Question for Dr. Seeley. I enjoy your presentations. On one of your slides, you called the year 2010 the wettest year in Minnesota state average annual precipitation, and then later on, in the listing of years that had drought, 2010 is also listed. So my question is, how do we define drought? What's the threshold for saying we're in a drought? Or just explain that, please.
The tool used to assess drought in this country has been the Palmer Drought Index for multiple decades of time. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, along with the Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska, conducts drought assessment on a weekly basis, state by state, county by county in the U.S. The definitions for levels of drought are defined in a description of the Palmer Drought Index. I can provide you personally with a lot more background on that. The fact that we have over 1,500 precipitation observers in the state of Minnesota is the pool of data that went into the assessment of annual precipitation, and it's that pool data that we use to define 2010 as the wettest year on a statewide basis. Embedded in those data were counties and individual observers within townships that were so deficient in precipitation that they had fallen in the class 3 or class 4 Palmer drought category of severe or extreme drought. So embedded in the wettest year in state history, we did have sections of the landscape that were indeed in class 3 or class 4 drought for some period of time.
Thank you. Representative Earhart, did you have a question?
I did, Madam Chair. When I was here a few years ago, I think some attitudes have changed, but I'm going to check. You folks are all scientists here today, and you're convinced that we're in a period of climate change, I assume. And secondly, would you also be convinced that global warming might be a part of what's happening here?
Or
we are in a period of global warming that might have some something to do with our climate change.
Dr. Seeley, can you help us out there?
Yes, to give credit to Representatives Hausman and Wiginius briefly, this goes back to an earlier question. When these hearings were formulated on what content and who professionally you were going to hear from, they had invited Dr. John Foley, the director of our Institute on the Environment, who is probably among our University of Minnesota faculty, perhaps the most knowledgeable person to address your question, and he was unfortunately ill and could not come. In his stead, I would say that as a member of the climate science community for 4 decades, the answer is emphatically yes, that the climate of planet Earth is changing. It's changing in significant ways. It's not changing uniformly. You can still find areas on the Earth landscape where it's hard to find the signal of climate change. However, in many, many areas, it is very significant. The human fingerprint, by all the recent research, is embedded in these signal changes. We don't yet have it all sorted out, and we can't be completely precise about it, but we do know that the manner in which we've altered the Earth's landscape by manipulation and the manner in which we've altered the Earth's composition of its atmosphere have, in fact, driven some of this climate change. That's widely acknowledged. I think well over 90% of the science community accepts that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one last question from Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this probably comes under the category of data gap. I didn't hear, and I was listening for it, any description of disproportionate impact of these changes, whether they're human or agency-wide or infrastructure, on low-income communities and communities of color. We usually call that an issue of environmental justice or injustice, and I guess I'm looking for that, and I'm hoping all the presenters will start to think about that more in the future, because I think there's maps that could be drawn that would show us some of those impacts that I didn't see or hear about today.
Thank you. I think that's more of a comment than a question. And with, yes, Dr. Seeley.
I'd just like to pass along, it is somewhat relevant to that question. I'd like to pass along information to this committee that in addition to the committee, the multi-agency committee that David Thornton represents in terms of looking at climate adaptation and resilience for our state as a whole, we have a broader scoped committee on climate adaptation partnerships that later this year will be hosting a conference at the Science Museum here in downtown St. Paul on climate adaptation practitioners. We are going to be looking at a broader scope of practicing climate adaptation and resilience across a wide range of communities and a wide range of disciplines. And we hope to start something of a public nature where we can share that each year and give case-by-case, example-by-example
across a wide range of communities as to how this is successfully being approached. I think the committee ought to be aware that we're moving in that direction.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think we are going to be having similar conversations, and to the extent we can join up, that would be great. I hear proposals from members where we are going to tighten up our buildings to make them more comfortable in this climate change with lots more insulation. That same insulation is going to have us use less energy and reduce the climate change gases. So we're going to be looking for win-wins as much as we can, where we can both prevent and adapt. So with that, members, I totally appreciate your coming, and many thanks to the folks who worked hard for the presentation. With that, we're adjourned.